How are you most like your grandfather, Jack Cowdery?
That's a good question. Probably I'd go first with the best things. I believe in keeping my word, which he certainly did. I believe in other people, which he had to, as a banker in the little town he opened, where he opened his bank in southern Alberta, quite not far from the Montana border. I'm happy to take risks and have a sense of adventure.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Canadian author Edward Chamberlain about his book, The Banker and the Blackfoot, an untold story of friendship, trust, and broken promises of the Old West. This interview was recorded with the support of CITR at the University of British Columbia. Don't go away. The book begins with a gift. Can you tell the story of the transaction between Crop-Eared Wolf and your grandfather?
Sure. They met by chance shortly after my grandfather had arrived in the town called Fort McLeod, south of Calgary, about 60 miles south of Calgary. And one day, about a week after he got there, he was riding out along the main, wide main street of the little town. A fellow was coming the other way, leading a string of horses, riding in a way that my grandfather recognized as Blackfoot-style short stirrups with a blanket over him because it was a coolish day. They stopped to exchange greetings, which they did in a sign language that they both understood, that my grandfather knew well from his time across the prairies. They spoke for a while about horses. First of all, they chatted about some other things, had a brief conversation, and left clearly both thinking, not such a bad fellow, which played out about 6 months later when my grandfather was riding south from Calgary down through past McLeod to a place near the Montana border, in fact, to see some people. And it was wintertime, bitterly cold, some snow on the ground, and he got snow blind. Now, snow blindness, at best, a nuisance. At worst, it can be deadly because you lose your sense of direction completely. You go blind. Fortunately, his horse knew the direction and, in that way of horses, sensed where there were other horses near where the snow blindness finally overtook him. So he let the horse have its head, and the horse took him to Crop-Eared Wolf's home down south of Fort McLeod. So his horse took him in to Crop-Eared Wolf's by the teepee he was living in, and where his horses were, Crop-Eared Wolf helped him off, recognized him, took him in, and brought him back to good health. Over the next 4 or 5 days, they talked probably pretty constantly over that time. My grandfather, not knowing Siksika, the language of the Blackfoot, of Crop-Eared Wolf, but Crop-Eared Wolf had some English. What made the conversation much easier was the appearance in Crop-Eared Wolf's teepee of a man named John McLean, who was a Methodist missionary living with the Blackfoot down in their encampment down there, and widely respected by them. So he translated, they talked together, and then my grandfather, when he was feeling better, went on his way, feeling by that time quite close to Crop-Eared Wolf. Their paths crossed a whole bunch of times over the next few years. And one day, unexpected, Crop-Eared Wolf arrived at my grandfather's place in Fort McLeod with a gift. And the gift was a ceremonial riding crop called the quirt, carved and painted in very detailed ways by Crop-Eared Wolf, telling essentially the stories of some of his most famous adventures, both raids against his enemies, assaults on some of the camps and such, the court is a kind of record of, it's my grandfather used to call it boasting and toasting. It's saying, I did all these things, and they are truly extraordinary for the time, and I want to leave a testimony to them. And this is his testimony, is a gift to my grandfather. The book I wrote is in some ways the first step in giving back the gift. The second step will be, and I've been having conversations with the Blackfoot community and with Crabtree Wills family, the second step will be to give the court back into the community and into the family. That's the story of the court.
Wow. I was really struck by early on in the book that you make mention that your grandfather did not display the court. And as you said, it wasn't Jack Cowdery's trophy. It was Crop-Eared Wolf's testament, and that you felt that obligation. When did you know that you felt obligated to engage with that conversation?
Well, the court had been in the family since Crop-Eared Wolf gave it to my grandfather, and I don't know the precise date, but it would have been the early 1890s when he gave it to him. And I knew it was in the family. My mother kept it. My grandfather kept it. In fact, he died at the age of 90 in 1947, and my grandfather took it to the nursing home where he lived his last few months with him, which gives a sense of the preciousness of it to him and the preciousness of the friendship. There's no better word for the relationship between the two of them and between many people across all kinds of sort of them and us barriers in that time and place.
I want to talk about the differences between the Canadian West and the American West, because a couple of facts really struck me. One is that in the Canadian West, it was tempered by strict handgun laws, and many cowboys didn't even own a gun. So what impact do you think that had?
Combined with the fact that in order to clear the West for settlement, the Canadian government sent in a police force rather than the army. And that police force came, first of all, to deal with the illegal import of whiskey. Calling it whiskey, of course, is an exaggeration. It was everything, everything was thrown into that mix. But whiskey was doing terrible damage to many communities, but in particular to the Indian communities on the Western prairies. And the police came and very quickly shut down the whiskey trade. And the Blackfoot were enormously grateful because it transformed the communities from pretty dangerous and deadly places into places with all of the good things and all of the complications of lively communities. So you had the police force called the Northwest Mounted Police, which was based in McLeod, where my grandfather was. You had them on very good relations with the Blackfoot and enforcing the laws of the land. And they were an independent police force. I mean, they were appointed by the federal government. They became very much part of the community, but they weren't elected sheriffs. And so they weren't influenced in the same way as sheriffs and other law enforcement officials were in the states. To give you an example, early days after the buffalo had effectively gone from the prairies, late 1870s, the ranchers were starting up, and there was starvation across the Western Plains on both sides of the border. Very tough, very, very tough time. The ranchers, there weren't many, but a few of them went to visit James McLeod was his name. Fort McLeod was named after him, which is where they built their first fort, the Northwest Mounted Police. They came to visit him and say, you know, you got to do something about the situation. Our Indians are stealing our cattle. McLeod then said to them, if you were starving, wouldn't you steal cattle? They all said, yep, yeah, we would. But they said, we've got to find some way of protecting what are our vulnerable herds. And these weren't big cattle herds at that time, small herds. And these were folks who were struggling to hold on. Can we protect our cattle? He said, you can watch over your cattle, but if anyone kills an Indian, he'll hang. So, and that gives one sense of how stern the enforcement of the laws was. And when you catch that with the absence of guns, because guns, they passed a law enforced by the North Osmond Police that guns weren't allowed in saloons. So you put those together, and it was the men and women were no better than they were south of the border. They were just living in a somewhat different context, and that context made a difference. There were a couple of other things that made a big difference, too. One was the regimes governing the use of land. Canada allowed large leases of very large tracts of land to winter the cattle, and they restricted radically until the early decades of the 20th century the settlement of farmers. So you didn't have the conflicts between farmers and ranchers that gave rise to the range wars south of the border. The reason for doing that was to nourish the ranching, but also to protect the water sources, because this is semi-desert country of that right. northern plains. I mean, it can be very dry for long stretches of time. And when you get farmers wanting and needing water and ranchers wanting and needing water, you get a pretty volatile and dangerous sort of mix. So those were some of the differences, and guns certainly played a part. This isn't to say that Canada was, in some ways, in its relations, certainly with the Indigenous people, with the Indians, much better. But I always think of that Woody Guthrie line, as through this world I wander, I see lots of funny men. Some will rob you with a six-gun, and some with a fountain pen. Canada specialized in the fountain pen when it came to taking Indian land.
One of the commonalities is that on the cover of this book is Chief Mountain, which holds great significance, I know, to the Blackfeet south of the border and to folks who are familiar with the area in northwest Montana around Glacier National Park. What can you say about Chief Mountain from the perspective of your book?
I love that it's on the cover and figures at several points in the book because it's sacred. It's a sacred place. Now, as you know, and your listeners, many of them may know, in north of the border, the Blackfeet called themselves Blackfoot rather than Blackfeet. But to the Blackfoot in southern Alberta, Chief Mountain was a very special place with all kinds of legends associated with it. And the lovely thing about it for me was it's in Montana. And it kind of reinforces that sense that the border, honestly, it didn't really matter a damn to the Blackfoot. I mean, they acknowledged it as it became an important sort of place of transition. But they had many, many relatives down among the Blackfeet. They had been traveling there for generations, certainly for hundreds of years, to follow the buffalo. And their kind of spiritual center of their spiritual life was a mountain in Montana. And they were in southern Alberta. So it catches both the importance of certain places like Chief Mountain and the whole of the Rockies, the backbone of the world, the Blackfoot in Canada called the Rockies as they rolled up to their west and north. And it catches the uncertain character and very permeable character of that border. People were back and forth across it all the time. Many of the ranchers in southern Alberta came bringing herds of cattle up from Wyoming and Montana and stayed because there was good land. I mean, that land was remarkably clear of the encroachments of farming settlement, and that meant that it was kind of the same land that the Blackfoot had roamed on. A wonderful feed, summer and winter.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Edward Chamberlain about his book, The Banker and the Blackfoot, an untold story of friendship, trust, and broken promises of the Old West. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. I want to transition to talking about your grandfather's field, which was banking. And one of the things that surprised me was that you wrote, "To be a banker, he would insist, you have to believe and dream a bit too, right alongside your customers." What is the relationship between banking and dreaming?
Let me put it this way. The word credit, which is central to banking, means from its old Latin root, he or she believes. And when you give someone credit, you have to believe in them. Otherwise, you're an idiot. He wasn't an idiot, and he believed in the people he loaned money to. But one of the reasons that his bank was so popular and so successful was there were no other banks there at the time he started his, no other banks that would lend money. There were some kind of outlying travelers from the big Eastern banks, but they always wanted security. Nobody had security in that time. You had winters that could wipe out half your herd. These were early days, and many of the people didn't have much cattle. They didn't have many possessions. They just had a belief that they could make ranching work, and they did. My grandfather, the first year he opened the bank, 1886, and he didn't have much money. He opened it with his brother. They had some experience. They come from Ontario. They had a bit of experience when they were younger, in their late teens and early 20s, working in separate banks in Ontario. They came out and homesteaded on the Saskatchewan prairies, but they, when they came out west, what they had was belief and a dream and enough money and enough knowledge about how a bank takes in some money in savings and then loans it out to get the bank started. The first winter was one of those devastating winters. It was called the roundup in the spring was called the big die-up rather than the big roundup, right through the northern plains, the winter of 86, 87. And many farmers lost half, some lost almost all their herds. So there's my grandfather, his first year in the business. All the people he'd loaned money to had no way possible of paying them back. So he waived the interest on the loans, extended the terms, and said, let's see what the next season brings. And it brought a wonderful bumper year for ranching. So with that start, from then on, things went pretty well. They had other good and bad years, but people believed in them. I mean, there's one story I kind of like. There was a fellow who was with the Northwest Mounted Police who had been called to account by the then superintendent of the police in Fort McLeod for having been moderately drunk on duty. So he was about to be fired from the police service. He owed my grandfather money because he had borrowed the money to invest in a mine out on the BC side of the border. And we all know investing in small mines is hazardous at the best of times. These weren't the easiest of times. So here he was facing a situation where he had no income and was likely to lose all that money. And he said to a group gathered, and the story went down through the community, said to a group gathered in the Northwest Mounted Police headquarters, he said, "I feel sorry for Cowdery." How many times have you felt sorry for a bank manager? I must say, I haven't often. But he became a central part of the community, and the community helped each other out. And they needed him. They needed each other. They needed the Blackfoot, too. So they, all through the community, they did all kinds of things to ensure the Blackfoot got through what, for them, were the devastatingly tough times of the collapse of the Buffalo.
Right. I want to talk about that grief because it seemed to be a theme both on a large scale and a personal level. You know, the devastation of the buffalo, the loss of land for the Blackfoot, and then also Jack suffering a number of losses. What do you think made him able to empathize with the Blackfoot?
I think the first thing is that kind of the intangible quality of friendship. Crop-eared Wolf was his closest friend, but the Big Swan, who was the chief of the Piegan, who another of the Blackfoot tribes, was also a very good friend. And he knew them, and he heard their stories, and he certainly believed their stories, and he recognized their vulnerability. Because for all of the good things I've been saying, there were some people around, especially the agents of the federal government, the Indian agents, and some, but by no means all of the missionaries, who would have been much happier if the Blackfoot disappeared from the face of the earth. Life would have been much easier, they thought, or much more convenient, or much simpler, let me put it that way. The community and the Northwest Mounted Police, at every time they tried to do things to damage especially the pride of the Blackfoot, they would do things like, they tried to outlaw the Sundance, which was a great summer gathering for many, many of the Northern Plains tribes on both sides of the border. The missionaries, who weren't all that keen on the Sundance themselves because they were trying to convert the Indians to Christianity, they went up against the Indian agents and said, "You cannot do that." And the police themselves said, "We can't arrest somebody at a Sundance. That would be like arresting somebody in church." So there was all kinds of collaboration going on among the white community, not exclusively white. There, as I tell in the book, there were some very notable black ranchers, for example, and lots of vaqueros from Mexico were part of the ranching system. But that settler community, call them that, they recognized the importance of the Blackfoot. They learned from the Blackfoot something that served them well, which is when something goes wrong, don't sit around looking for who to blame. Look for what to do next.
Part of what I was wondering is, you know, what connects us as humans is both maybe the ways that we celebrate being alive, but also the ways that we suffer. I was sort of wondering how Jack changed by losing two of his wives, both during childbirth, I think.
Yes, yeah, there were my grandmother was one, and then his first wife he lost during childbirth. He lost two children. One thing I'd say, never can say it enough, is the women, Indian, settler, just women in those early years especially, were courageous in giving birth in a way that the best warrior wouldn't even understand. I mean, because so many of them died in childbirth or shortly after, the children died. And my grandfather clearly brought that experience, not one he would have ever wanted, into play in his understanding of the situation for many Blackfoot. And many of his close friends, including Crop-Eared Wolf and Big Swan, but also Jerry Potts, who was a part Blackfoot, part Scots, in fact, a Métis guide and a very important figure at the time. He lost several children. Everyone was vulnerable. Everyone still is vulnerable to ill health and suffering, but it was more immediate. And though there was reasonable medical care, nothing saved too many of the women.
Mm-hmm. One of the passages that you wrote says, "To be fully human, we need to both surrender to a story and separate ourselves from it. Live in both grief-stricken reality and the grace of imagination. Believe the stories we are told and not believe them too." How did this impact your writing of the book?
Well, my regular trade for years was literature. What brought me to this book was stories. literature is a fancy name for stories and songs. And I guess what there's all these very complicated responses to story. I mean, we all know how easily a song can bring us to tears. We know stories that make us both laugh and cry at the same time. In a sense, there's a mystery there about storytelling and about song. It's one of the elements at the heart of being human, that surrender to story. It's that, in some ways, it's like that dreaming, that element of believing that I was talking about a minute ago, but much deeper, much more universal, and in many ways among the most powerful of the experiences of being human. And for me, hearing my grandfather's stories, I knew him when I was really young, so I do remember him telling stories, but I certainly wasn't taking them in the way I would now. But my mother, who was a wonderful storyteller, would tell me them, and so would a cousin I had who died a few years ago, but he was much older than me, but my grandfather's first wife, and he knew lots of the stories. Listening to them, kind of get almost overwhelmed by the power of the story, and then take it back. And for me, it became clear that one of the things that saved the Blackfoot were stories. And stories in a variety of forms, as I said, not all of them spoken or written down, not very few of them at the time written down, but in a variety of forms, carvings, paintings, weavings, and so forth. And in some ways, for me, the book is about the power of friendship, probably first of all, and of community, and of stories.
Will you take us out by reading the last paragraph, please?
Listening to others is the first courtesy, and a custom which Jack Cowdery and Crop-Eared Wolf both rendered and respected. They are the presiding spirits of this book. They open doors, and they also shut doors against the bullies and the breakers of promises. They left us with a line of credit to be used in building a world of customs and courtesies. And most of all, they left us with some promises to keep and a couple of questions. What have we done? And what do we do next?
Edward Chamberlain is Professor Emeritus of English and Comparative Literature at the University of Toronto and a Fellow of the Royal Society of Canada. He lives near Vancouver, British Columbia. Look for more information about his work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008, and thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.